but I'll can you say your name and spell it?
All right. So I'm Kathy Kelly, K A T H Y K E L L Y.
And what group are you with, Kathy?
I'm with Voices for Creative Nonviolence.
Do you think many people know who you are in this country?
Oh, I think within the peace movement, Voices is recognized and maybe my name is known. But I would say beyond that movement of people, I'm an unknown.
What about in other parts?
Well, I think similarly, there would be a small group in certain parts of the world who would recall or know of Voices' work, but a pretty limited grouping.
The peace movement is pretty small. Oh, here's a cat. It's all right.
She's a beautiful cat. Lagrima is her name.
So around the world, the peace movement may be equally small. What's your assessment of the global peace movement?
Well, maybe if we widen it out a bit into global peace and justice efforts, then I think we've just seen this remarkable demonstration of young people in Hong Kong holding their space and saying that they wouldn't accept the government's rules about upcoming elections. And I think in Chile, again, young people have stood very strong initially, saying that they had a right to lessen the amount charged for their tuition, but then becoming the federated students are so strong that the government can't dismiss them, and now two of their leaders are in elected positions in Chile. I think we can anticipate that the people that are working on environmental movements and anti-war movements and trying to lessen the gaps in terms of income differences will find common cause more and more. So it's hard to assess what the strength of these various resistance movements might be at this point.
But they seem to be getting younger.
I certainly hope so.
You have been engaged in the work of peace for some time, 20 years?
Oh, I think I would say that I got started in 1980.
That's more than 20 years.
Yeah, it's quite a stretch.
And are sometimes you finding yourself discouraged or puzzled at where you find yourself?
Well, I suppose I feel my share of discontent that the ferociousness, the viciousness of attacks continues, and the kind of predictable spiraling of warfare and the incredible deluge of weaponry and ammunition all around the world, that all of this continues. And that makes me feel sad and challenged. But as far as the privilege of being able to kind of align your life and in accord with what one believes, I think I've been exceptionally fortunate in that regard. I've been able to do that to an extent that at least eases my sense of anxiety a bit. And along the way, have been accompanied by some of the finest people in the world and enjoyed good companionship and had many mentors and many people whom I just like to work with. And so that's been a real blessing.
Do you think that as a citizen of the United States, have a special responsibility, since the United States, the source for that viciousness, as we see that during Israel's attack on the Palestinian civilians last summer, took time to send bombs, rockets, that were requested against the laws of the United States that forbid that day and a time of war, to facilitate the Israelis in their shredding of human beings?
Well, I certainly remember being in Gaza in 2009 and being surprised at the Al-Shifa Hospital, where so many of the patients during the Operation Cast Lead had been brought in, and the doctors labored over survivors and sent corpses to the morgue, and it had been just a horrific time for the doctors. And when the bombing ended, some university students and I went to Al-Shifa Hospital, hoping we could interview some of the doctors. And one of them turned out to be somebody who'd grown up in the Lakeview neighborhood, which is just quite near here in Uptown where I live. And so we talked with each other, and he told me about the conditions they labored under, with white phosphorus having been used, and having to back off away from the operating table because the fumes from the white phosphorus would begin to be emitted when they were trying to remove white phosphorus from under the skin of patients. The doctors were then inhaling the fumes, because as soon as the white phosphorus is exposed to oxygen, it starts to burn again. Well, then he talked about these dense inert metal explosive weapons that directly amputated, like cleanly amputated limbs of patients. And he said, we've never seen these kinds of things before as doctors. And so then I said, well, what do you want me to tell people back in your neighborhood? And he said, well, tell them that we don't have the prostheses, and tell them we don't have the equipment. And then he stopped himself and he said, no, I am completely wrong. Just you go back and tell people United States taxes helped pay for these weapons. So that for me was a very dramatic moment of sensing our collective culpability, the accountability, the idea that, we're not on the sidelines, we're not bystanders. But I think that the main task I see right now is education. How do you educate a public that is so saturated in a description of the United States' role as the exceptional figure upholding justice around the world? Many people believe that the United States is the necessary defender of democracy and the necessary endorser of humanitarian concern, and that you do this by using the military. So there's a lot to kind of undo that people wrongfully believe. And then I think we have to be so thoughtful trying to understand, what is it that people want from their government, and what are they afraid they might lose if the government's policies changed? And as I think about that, it seems to me that people in government are pretty confident that an abiding attitude of most of their constituents who put them into governance in the first place is that the governing people should keep doing what they do. Don't rock the boat. Don't displace the level of comfort that we've grown accustomed to. And when that seems to be threatened, then there will be, a bit more of an attentiveness on the part of the public. And so to try to work with that understanding and try to alter that's one thing. And then the other is that I think many people are very frightened that if the United States were to alter its foreign policy and not rely as much as it does on the military, on threat and force, and not just threatening, but sometimes supplying the weapons as they've done with Israel, or using weapons as we've done with drone warfare.
Major exporter of weapons.
Yeah, if we alter that, it will affect jobs. And people are very, very afraid about losing jobs in this economy. And so part of our work, I think, in terms of education is to help people imagine, what if you wouldn't lose your jobs? There would be other jobs that would be created, because we'd be servicing the needs of an environment that is desperate for protective measures so that we stop destroying our environment. What if people could imagine jobs created because we would be taking care of our elderly people and doing a better job of caring for the little children? What if jobs were created because we were serious about fixing a crumbling infrastructure? So these are all education tasks, and there are certainly varying ways to go about that education. I don't find a lot of inspiration in what's been happening in the mainstream education institutions. In fact, a lot of them are co-opted by the military defense establishment and subservient to it. But I think the peace movement constantly, all across this country, is trying, each little group is trying to find its way to be assertive and to accomplish some measure or some part of that those tasks I've mentioned.
Are you in contact with each little group?
Well, I do travel.
Is it that small that
Well, it's just that I travel around a lot. People are, I don't turn out big audiences, but I do have a pretty steady schedule of meeting with small groups of dedicated people, really all across the country.
All across the country. So the fact that people in the country don't know of you or Voices, by and large, or that their neighbors are opposed to war, the lack of awareness comes out of media inattention. Would you say a policy that how often are you on Nightline, if it's still around, or whatever the contemporary equivalent is? Have you been on the Jon Stewart show, or invited to what purports to be a public interest network, National Public Radio or public television, to talk about the work for peace, and firsthand, most recently, Afghanistan?
Well, I would say that, for instance, National Public Radio has had Sean Carberry there. I think he's packing up and leaving. But some of these more wealthy, seasoned mainstream media places, if they have their own correspondent or if they're paying a stringer, then they're certainly not going to put on somebody from a group like Voices for Creative Nonviolence. You know, they might send their person over to interview one of us, but that very rarely happens. We've, like in Afghanistan, we've always kind of known who's working over at BBC. If we hold an event in Kabul and invite the media to come, there's a chance that maybe somebody from mainstream media will come over and visit with us. We got to know John Stevenson very well from the McClatchy, a New Zealander, McClatchy News. But I think that the mainstream media is so unlikely to pay attention to the perspectives that our group has or the work that we don't really even try very hard anymore. We don't send out press releases to a national list of mainstream media.
Because you've written them off.
Yeah, I don't feel very good about saying that, but we haven't even tried to update our lists. And, you know, you can send faxes and make phone calls and send emails and never hear a word back. And after a while, you start getting the message, you know, don't bother. So we could be wrong. Maybe I had a lot more energy when I was younger for giving that a good try.
You think they don't want to hear the narrative that you have based on your direct experience?
Well, I think that they would find that their own credibility might be challenged when they could just as easily go to people representing large, well-known, recognized groups or the military, then why ever in the world would they dip into small groups you want?
What does it take to have street cred? I mean, you're working with women who've lost their husbands, children who've lost their parents, people who've lost their jobs. And
well, it's interesting that you'd ask that, because actually I probably have more freedom of movement and have had exponentially more freedom of movement than some of the mainstream correspondents, because the mainstream correspondents will, by rules of their own company, tend to travel around in vehicles that have armed security. They are not allowed into households if there are women present, if they're male interviewers, for instance. And just by the very bulk of their equipment, they probably would be unlikely to gain access to places. I can go walk up the mountainside with a couple of the young teenagers and walk into any home.
You're both in foreign countries, yet you have an engagement.
Well, I will say that in Iraq, we were so desperate to try to communicate to U.S. people that children were writhing in pain on blood-stained mats, and they were bereft of anesthetics, they were bereft of antibiotics, they were starving in many cases, suffering from a combination of gastroenteritis and starvation, just suffering gruesomely. And we felt that if we could just get a mainstream media person into a hospital, and if that person would write or speak or show visual images of what was happening to these children, the economic sanctions wouldn't withstand the light of day. And we tried very, very hard to use our presence in Baghdad to connect with mainstream media and say, you know, would you be interested to go to this hospital? And for our efforts, there was some pretty nasty response on the part of some of the correspondents.
The bureau chiefs or the individual correspondents?
Well, I'm digging back in memory a bit. Now, let me say one of the positive responses came from Stephen Kinzer, who wrote the, as I recall, the only story that ever appeared in the New York Times about the suffering of children under economic sanctions. And it was front page and carried on to another page further on in the front section, and there were big pictures. And I always admired Stephen Kinzer for writing that story. He immediately came to us afterward and said, give me all the documentation that you can. And, you know, he worked on a story, and it was a very, very comprehensive and good story. But NPR correspondents came, a couple of them, along with somebody from another bureau, and they actually said, well, meet us. We'd like to meet you over dinner. And when we encouraged them to go to a hospital, they said, oh, no, we'll never give your group a platform. No, I'm sorry, that was said over the phone by an NPR bureau person. We'll never give your group a platform. And we tried to clarify, no, we're not looking for a platform for our group. We're trying to communicate about these children who have no voice but have no responsibility whatsoever for the regime, and yet they're being punished. And so that didn't fly. And then the correspondents who said, yeah, we'd like to meet you for dinner, said no, they would not become the dupes of Saddam Hussein by going to a hospital. They actually equated going into a hospital and telling the true story that was going on there with being subservient to Saddam Hussein, as though somehow Saddam Hussein's government had set up all of these dying children as a good story to tell to show how wicked the Americans were. I mean, the children were suffering and dying no matter what your political view was. And then what it would have enraged me, really, although I didn't express my anger, but I was furious. The NPR correspondent then said, you know what I'm really interested in? My son's got a coin collection. He's really got a good numismatics hobby going on. Where could I find some good coins to collect in this city? I actually thought of standing up on the table and starting to scream. But so that was Iraq. With regard to Afghanistan and the ongoing war in Afghanistan, it does actually surprise me that if Afghanistan has appeared in the page as a story in one way or another as often as it has in the New York Times in the past several months, because the troops are going out, and my expectation was that there just wouldn't be any more attention paid whatsoever. But the Special Inspector General reports are getting some play.
There's a major energy corridor that goes through Afghanistan, and the troops are not going out.
Well, thank you. Yeah, they're not all going out. There is a reduction.
They're not only not all going out, but they exist in another form as private contractors.
And that's a very important question. We still don't have an answer as to how many private contractors are staying. We know that there were 100,000, and that the troops that are going to remain, although President Obama has said they'd be involved in limited combat, the truth is they'll be accompanying Afghan National Army soldiers on the night raids, and I don't see how anyone could say there's a limit to the fighting that breaks out in those night raids. If there's any resistance shown whatsoever by the householders or family members, they can immediately be shot. And if the Taliban do engage in any kind of resistance, then civilians are caught in the crossfire. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't mean to say the troops are leaving. I'm one of the people, I suppose, who's been most adamant in trying to offset that notion. But I still think the mainstream media has continued to pay attention to Afghanistan. And it's important that people not forget this country, Afghanistan, because we've wrecked it. And I think there's a great cause for the United States to pay reparations. So I'd like not to see the war in Afghanistan forgotten.
As I mentioned, there's a major energy corridor for natural gas through there.
Well, it's interesting. Right after the bilateral security agreement was signed and President Obama had indicated that the troops would remain, and then President Ashraf Ghani of Afghanistan said that the night raids were back on. Then the government of Turkmenistan said, and we're now ready to start building that pipeline again. So how are they ever going to get that pipeline built when there might be insurgent anti-government groups who, once a stretch of the pipeline is constructed, might go out at night and blow it up? I think they want to know who are those groups and how can they control that.
Well, maybe you can relate that story about the Taliban and UNICAL and the fact that it came to pass that they were going to be bombed.
Well, the pipeline construction had begun, and UNICAL was looking to build what was called the TAPI pipeline, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India pipeline. The construction has been stymied and has not resumed. Now, as far as a deal that soured with the Taliban, you'll have to pick up that story.
They were brought to the United States. You remember that at one point they met with Reagan, called them
Freedom Fighters.
Freedom Fighters, that's right. And they went to Houston and were offered a deal, take it or leave it. They said, no, that's insufficient.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't long after that justification for attacking Afghanistan came to pass.
Yeah, it's a sordid history. And, of course, now there's also some speculation that the United States is interested in controlling the pricing and the flow of rare earth minerals that are underneath the Hindu Kush Mountains, and not wanting China or Russia to have access to those minerals in a way that might give them better pricing. I would say that in a small group of people that I interact with, you could easily have this conversation. There are a few people who speak English who have had a chance to study these kinds of issues and are quite savvy, kind of up on the issues. And certainly the Afghan Analysts Network would be very, very prepared to talk with you. The Afghan peace volunteers have worked hard to keep themselves on top of current events and to learn to analyze what's happening. And they really impress me. I mean, they're 16, 17, 18 years old, but they're very gripped by world events, and they are kept kind of informed by their mentor, a man named Hakim. He's a Singaporean MD, and he's a very trusted mentor. And then also they get a steady stream of internationals coming to visit them, who tend to have a perspective that's highly critical of militarism and highly regretful of the ways that corporate greed has affected the country of Afghanistan, and the ways that we've complacently lived better because we've been able to so bully the people all around the world to make sure that we can take other people's resources at cut-rate prices. So they've heard from some very fine and very engaging people coming from Australia, from New Zealand, from the United Kingdom, and from the United States and a few other countries in Europe, from Ireland, from Belgium, Germany. So they tend to hear the same ideas reinforced by peace activists and who've come from many parts of the world. So I think they start to think, these people have something to say that sounds believable to us.
It does ring with a certain truth.
You know, they call John Kerry Coco Kerry, and they're very aware that Kerry was able to kind of say, look, we'll cut off all the funds to all of y'all if you don't hurry up and get yourselves sorted out in terms of an election. And the European Parliament said well, this election was fraudulent, but I think the United States wanted an election to happen so they could get that bilateral security agreement signed so that they could start to, you know, reconstruct pipelines. And only the immunity of any U.S. soldier, no matter what he or she might do, and they've done some hideous things. The Amnesty International report released on August 11th gives 10 case studies of just hideous, grotesque actions on the part of the U.S. military against civilians, and inclusive of torture, disappearance, murder, and airstrikes, including drone strikes, that caused great rage and bereavement. But also environmentally, you know, every single base that the United States constructed involved consuming a lot of energy, certainly, but also a tremendous pollution, scattering ordnance, some of it unexploded ordnance, all around the local grounds, massive burn pits. I mean, it wasn't good for the soldiers either who were living in those spaces. The cleanup is just not going to happen, and there's no way that the United States can be held accountable now for environmental damages under any kind of Afghan law.
The children you work with, who are they?
Well, there were a group of youngsters.
Who work with you, actually.
Yeah. I mean, I don't work very much. I listen. I wash a lot of dishes. Try to learn their language and try to bring back some stories of what they've been doing to others. But a group started from the Hazara, largely Hazara province called Bamyan, and came to Kabul primarily because there were death threats being issued to their mentor and to others in the group because they had tried to live together inter-ethnically through a university program initially. And there were Tajik and Hazara and eventually Pashto people in a small live-in community. So that moved over to Kabul. And from that small group, there developed what we've now called the Afghan Peace Volunteers and several projects that they started, the duvet project, distributing 3,000 very heavy blankets to the poorest of people living in the most wretched circumstances during harsh winters, and paying seamstresses to make them so the Westerners and Australians raised the money to pay the seamstresses to buy the materials. The young people organized the project. It took a lot of organizing work, and the duvets, once they're made, are distributed free of charge. And then the Street Kids Project invites youngsters to stop working on the streets and compensates their parents for an equivalent amount of what the children might earn as shoeshine boys or selling chewing gum. And girls and boys come to the center. They become literate through some very good classes. Some of the young Afghan peace volunteer women are excellent teachers. I just can't get over their skill. And they've got these kids now becoming literate, learning math. And then they also make sure the kids are well clothed, that they get warm enough clothing for the winter, and that they can go back to school. So that's a good program. Global awareness programs go quite well also. And so they've now set up a border-free center, and it's from that center where the young people then invite many other young people to come and be part of various kinds of education programs.
From other parts of Afghanistan or from other countries?
Well, this is all Kabul. They want to go out and do outreach in other provinces, but the security has been taking a huge dip lately. The roads aren't safe. Our Pashto friends haven't been able to go back and visit their own families that are part of the community. The Hazaras are very aware that it's a risky road when they go back to their province. And yesterday, the Secret Service, that's a very feared group in Afghanistan, came by yesterday and then a few visits over the past 2 weeks, asking questions: who are you, why are you here, are you connected to Christian proselytizers, who visits you, who is this fellow Hakim? So that's very, very, very worrisome when that happens. So
Have been there for a while. They must be a little slow on the uptake.
And well, it's not the first time they've come. I remember one time they came while I was there, and who is she? And the kids just said, she's our grandmother. They seem to accept that. I don't know. But it is worrisome. And anyway, the security is not at this point such that they could be easily traveling to other provinces. But they do have phone contact. And email contact with at least one person in every other province of Afghanistan. And that's impressive.
If people were moved to help them, how would they do that?
Well, on the 21st of every month, there's a phone call, a Skype phone call. It's interesting. It's called Global Days of Listening. And if somebody were moved to get up at 7 o'clock in the morning, and if they have Skype to go through live streaming to listen to this call, you could hear the young people talking with people in other parts of the country. This next one coming up will especially focus on permaculture and organic farming. And the young people have got access now to a plot of land, and they want to really...
In Kabul.
Yeah, just on the outskirts. And they really want to learn all about organic farming and permaculture. And then if somebody was interested in the Street Children's Program, we now need to raise the money for making sure that 26 youngsters, they're going to bring five more into the program, will be able to give their parents once a month a big sack of rice and a large container of oil. And then everybody working in the program is a volunteer, but there are needs for book bags and supplies. So that would be something someone could become
just
involved
like you.
With. Yeah. And then the DeVe Project is, I think we've pretty well hit our goal for how much we had hoped to earn, but I will be receiving later today a large collection of blue scarves that are embroidered. They say at one end border free and at the other end bedune mers, without a border. And these are made by the young women, and then I sell them for $10 a piece, and people can wear those at their own activist events and or give them as gifts. And our two friends from Voices who are just coming back, Patrick Kennelly and Billy Malloy, said, can we knock on your door when we get to Chicago? Then they'll head on to Milwaukee, and they want to drop off the next batch of scarves. So if anybody wanted to help out by exchanging $10 for a scarf, I'd be happy to go along with that. And then...
Is there any direct way to aid this project?
By sending money, for instance, to Kabul?
Kabul, or perhaps European?
We aren't aware of a way to send money to Kabul. We actually entrust it to human beings that are traveling. The Kabul Bank is a bit wobbly anyway, but the United States government could interfere with the wiring of money to the Kabul Bank. So I don't recommend that as a way to send money. The Australians sometimes entrust money to us to get over to Kabul. So our friends in the UK are questioned at the airport, you know, how much cash are you bringing in? So they're never looking to bring more in than what they want to use to fund their contribution to projects.
One gets the impression that Kabul is a violent other side of the moon from the way it's portrayed to us in the media, to the countryside that you get to see, the community you get to see. Can you say something about what it's like?
Well, in the summertime, I lived in a very conservative area where, in Kabul, where I don't think anybody had ever seen a Westerner before. And when people saw me, they would be startled. It did look like I was from the moon, I think, to them. It was safer because the Taliban wouldn't bother to go to that neighborhood to attack someone because they didn't think there were any Westerners there. But it was a very, very conservative neighborhood, and as a few more Westerners arrived, the neighbors themselves started to say, wait a minute, you know, are these people going to affect our daughters? Are the young men and the young women talking to each other? That society is so conservative in the families that would come from more rural areas that if for a boy and a girl to exchange a text message could be tantamount to suggesting that they are now ready to get married. You know, you don't pair off that way without the family having made the arrangements, and that would subvert the culture very, very much. The girls and boys aren't supposed to be in the same room together. So it's a very, very, very conservative culture, and we have to be quite careful that we're both not seen as proselytizers of any kind, or that we're not breaking those norms by creating places where young people might kind of hang out with each other, boy meets girl type places. So that is unnerving to me. I don't want to create problems. But as far as feeling anxious for my own safety, it wasn't something I thought of very often. But of course, the random nature of the attacks means that nobody can really say, oh, I'm safe. Now, in the last couple of months, the attacks have ratcheted upward in Kabul, and so we now don't want Westerners to be living either at this border-free center or with the young males live-in community. We find it to be too dangerous.
It could place them in danger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Foreigners who come to Kabul who are not connected with government missions, are they independent? Are they with NGOs? Hmm. Are they with...
Well, most of the foreigners who come are with some kind of an organization. And it's interesting, in a couple of instances, just for someone to come and visit me at the Afghan Peace Volunteer Home, the organization had to send their own security people over to check me and the home out. And it's an odd choreography because, quite honestly, we don't want vehicles pulling up with armed guards and the logo of a foreign organization parked outside our door. So I suppose there's a mutual wariness. So I don't see foreigners very much. I think this past summer, I can honestly say I did not see a single foreigner until two people I knew from Chicago came over to visit, who've gone over to do relief work with another group. So that's a bit unusual to see foreigners. There have been a few people who've come over as writers, but not under the auspices of any particular broadcasting company or newspaper, and so as kind of freelancers, I have met a couple of them. I'm so impressed with an Italian group called Emergency. I should qualify not seeing foreigners. I do go over to that hospital and see the staff there, and I have O-negative blood, so they're always happy to see me. We do go to visit them and find out what their perspective is, how things are going, just about any time that I've gone over there, so I have seen them. There are some others who aren't connected to NGOs who have come over in the past. We have a Belgian friend and a couple of Australian friends. So it's not unusual for us to get visits. But I would say there isn't anything like a steady stream.
It was far more open in Iraq.
Well, toward the end of my stay in Iraq, it was becoming very, very dangerous for people to remain. We stayed until the middle of 2004, I think. We had a house following the shock and awe bombing. We moved out of the hotel where we were because, quite honestly, the hotel owners could make so much money by giving our rooms over to media people. They could, like, raise the price 5 times more than what we were paying. So we rented a home. I think we paid $1,800 for the entire year. And it was a large place. There were 3 floors. We gave the bottom floor over to a young group that was starting a newspaper, and then we had 2 additional floors. And that was a very good place to be in many, many ways. It was a welcoming spot. We could invite people that, you know, we had known but couldn't always be very free to talk with under the regime, but increasingly the neighbors began to be afraid that we would be targeted, and that whereas for the first year that we were there, little kids would be in and out all the time.
Targeted by the U.S. or by the regime?
Well, we didn't know, neither. Eventually, a car was parked across the street quite regularly, and the driver of the car would ask the neighbors questions about us. And the neighbors began to be very concerned that we were being targeted by some armed group, either for a kidnapping or for a bombing. And so they would no longer let their kids come into our house. And that was a sure sign that maybe we were starting to be a source of danger. Mm-hmm. And the other NGOs were systematically pulling out and saying anybody who stays is taking an undue risk. We so admired the Christian Peacemaker team for staying. What they were doing was crucial. They were finding out who was going into the prisons, where they were being transferred to. They kept a database up to date with 6,000 names and capture tag numbers, and they managed to kind of work it both ways. They'd go to the U.S. military and very politely say, could you give us information about the people you have in your prisons? And they got the information in many cases. And then they'd also go to family members and say, if you want us to try and track your loved one, we'll do that. You know, give us the name and the capture tag number. So they were, it was they that gave us the information we needed when we followed up on some people who were imprisoned in the Buka. It was called Camp Buka in Basra. And then they gave Seymour Hersh information, and that's how he got what he needed to disclose the Abu Ghraib findings.
Mm-hmm. Do you know that, I guess it was in the 70s, that Afghanistan, mainly Kabul, was westernizing, that mm-hmm. The status of women was quite advanced, the universities were filled with them, many going for professional degrees, many traveling abroad. It was very liberal socially, and that the Russians invaded in order to settle a dispute within the government, which was allied with Russia. They were having a civil war mm-hmm. that the Russians invaded to settle.
Yeah, I think it's always important for me to remind myself that Kabul is a small slice of the population of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. The majority of the people, even through that time of modernization within Kabul, lived in a rural setting that was isolated almost 100% really from modernizing trends.
Would you characterize it as feudal?
It's odd because I think that although the mullahs had a fair amount of power in those rural areas, they've got more now, because people feel more threatened by modernization and by the invasion of Westerners. So there tends to be more of a power accorded to the mullahs. But I think that the communities were fairly primitive. They didn't have anything like advanced methods of farming. Didn't have electricity, still don't, although in Bamiyan, for instance, people are getting solar power, which is a good advance. but there weren't roads, maybe motorcycles and bicycles, but not a lot of inter-province traffic, that's for sure. So I think it's always good for me to remember that, as Matthew Aikens has put it, referring to Kabul as Kabubble. Kabul is very, or some, you know, talk about whoever is president being the mayor of Kabul, really. Mm-hmm. It's very different from the rest of the country. There are a couple of other big cities, Herat in the Herat province, and then in Kandahar and in Helmand you'd find larger cities. But most of the country is small town and village.
You're soon to present yourself to go to jail, is my understanding. Can you talk about that and why in relation to the drones?
Yeah, well, I'm very, very troubled by the idea that a group of people can come up with a kill list and fly surveillance 24/7 over Afghanistan all day long, collecting miles and miles and miles of footage, and somehow determine who the bad guys are, and then fire hellfire missiles and drop 500-pound bombs into areas where civilians might be killed, where they may or may not have hit their intended target. Their intended target may or may not have been tied in with any kind of threat to the United States.
Always the word suspected.
Yeah, yeah, there were doubts, there were suspicions. That's what the mother of one of these young victims was told when she asked, "Why did you kill my son?" And the increasing number of bases in the United States that are being used now to operate the drones, including Air National Guard bases, troubles me. And the lack of information. When we went to Whiteman Air Force Base, Georgia Walker and I were amongst a group of about 30 people, I think, who really wanted to know, are the drones that are piloted by this base being used to kill people? And if so, how many? And are they destroying buildings? And what kinds of buildings? And what does your manual tell you about how to distinguish between a combatant and a non-combatant? And what if some of the pilots start to say, I don't want to do this anymore. What happens to them? And is there some kind of remedy for people who experience trauma? We had all kinds of questions, and we felt that this is how you open a dialogue. You go forward and you raise questions. So I wasn't feeling criminal when I took a loaf of bread and a letter and with Georgia decided to walk onto the base. And to walk onto the base, there's just like a stretch of pavement, and we walked maybe 25 feet along the pavement and crossed a line, and we were immediately apprehended by a team of soldiers who said, you can't go any further. And we said, well, excuse us, but we think we're exercising our First Amendment right. Well, that didn't go very far. And they said, please, we have to ask you to turn back. And then I said, well, actually, we think that the authority to this base may be being used to wage illegal warfare, and that you've usurped your own authority over this land because of the way that that wasn't working either. So they said, you know, you're going to have to turn back. And so we didn't, and we were immediately handcuffed and taken into custody. So we were charged with criminal trespass to a military installation and tried in Jefferson City, Missouri. And the judge agreed with the prosecutor that we posed a threat to the base security by acting as we did. And therefore, finding us guilty, he sentenced me to 3 months in prison and Georgia Walker to 1 year of probation.
The threat that was created by you?
Well, it's interesting. The prosecutor was actually upset that we were walking down the middle of the road. And I was kind of befuddled by that because I hadn't even seen the sidewalk. I guess there was one, but I didn't see it. It looked like the most natural thing to do, to walk along this road. There were no cars, there were no pedestrians. If there had been cars, I would have walked on the side of the road, but it was totally empty. And it was curious to me that this, to him, was a threat to security, while we're trying to raise the threat to the security of people in Afghanistan who are being attacked by 500-pound bombs and hellfire missiles, as, you know, they are walking along roadways. And it was also interesting to me that at the same time that we were in court being told you cannot walk down the middle of the road, you know, we're all thinking about Ferguson, where young people were walking down the middle of the road and they refused to cooperate with the police officer, and you know, ultimately a gun battle erupted, one-sided, and Michael Brown was killed. So this idea of walking along the road, I think all of us have good reason to ask ourselves, are we trying so hard to occupy the sidelines, you know, just to be bystanders, to be mesmerized viewers, that we sometimes miss our chance to walk forward and challenge the policies of a militarized police within this country, increasingly militarized police, and of a very dangerous and reckless foreign policy. It's 22 per day combat right. veterans right. kill themselves.
Right.
One young man had gone to Afghanistan,
right.
and Jacob George came back and he killed himself about, I think, maybe 2 months ago now. Yeah, there are people who have been speaking up, saying that they feel like they've undergone traumatic stress because of what they've seen and what they've been required to do. It's very worrisome, the trend toward more and more robotization of the warfare that the United States conducts is very troubling. And also, I think the word proliferation should be on all our minds, because this will become a process in militaries all around the world, as more and more resource and energy and brilliance will be directed toward creating the robotized means of killing. I do keep thinking of the doctor telling me, go back and tell people that U.S. taxpayers paid for these weapons. I think so many people in the United States just simply are not aware of the extent to which our military affects the lives of people in other lands, and the rage that people feel, and the way this jeopardizes their security. I think people feel so, so responsible to create a safe world for their children. You know, keep my children safe. That's the number one priority, and anything else is a far distant second. But the terrible irony is that by kind of insisting on safety for themselves and their loved ones, people allow the military to engage in policies which actually lower our safety, because we become so hated that other people will say, well, maybe it is okay to attack people that are connected to the United States or that are in the United States. Yeah, I felt very, very sad for all of the families that have borne such grief in this attack on the school children. It was a military school. Most of the children were the children of the military, and the Taliban have clearly declared that they were aiming to inflict misery and deep woe, because they wanted them to experience what they've experienced. Well, what have they experienced? And I know since 2009, the United States State Department under Hillary Clinton has been saying to the Pakistani government, do more, do more. You've got to do more to eradicate any kind of Taliban presence in North Waziristan. And so there have been steady attacks, and also the kinds of raids wherein people are pulled out of their homes and tortured and imprisoned and sometimes killed. So it doesn't surprise me that a group would say, well, we're going to retaliate. But then I don't see any end to this kind of spiraling violence. I think that even the New York Times today repudiated Imran Khan, a former soccer player who's a very populist kind of leader, who has said there has to be negotiation with these Taliban groups. And the New York Times said, no, you can't negotiate with these groups.
That's the ignorance of, is it an editorial?
It's on the editorial page.
It's the ignorance of the editorial board. to make such statements, because if you don't negotiate, you end up with exactly what has taken place.
Well, and I also think it's wrong for the United States to be saying to the Pakistani government, do more, do more.
Absolutely. The judge, I understand, or was it the prosecutor, said something to the effect that you just don't learn.
This very young military lawyer said to the judge, Your Honor, Miss Kelly is greatly in need of rehabilitation. And there were kind of wry smiles behind his back all throughout the courtroom, like, well, good luck. I was kind of surprised because the judge was clearly not pleased with the 4-page single-spaced record of my past arrests and court trials. And that was only the half. That was even, I mean, if they'd really recorded all the times I've been arrested, it would have been a pretty thick document. But the judge was not happy. And I thought, oh, he is going to give me the full 6 months of maximum penalty. So I was surprised he opted for 3 months. It's curious, this judge, in his job description, is not entrusted with responsibility to protect that base. But both in Brian Terrell's trial and with Georgia Walker and me, he again, this time reiterated that he feels the responsibility to help secure that base, and we were a threat to that security, but that's not his job.
Absolutely. And nor is someone with a loaf of bread walking down the middle of the street as an offering to the commander with a few questions the real source of threat to either base.
I do want to mention, though, that at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, where there will be a March 4th through 6th national mobilization to challenge drone warfare, at Hancock Field in Syracuse, where there's a brilliant and steady challenge to the usage of Hancock Field to wage drone warfare. And they're in and out of the courts every week, and many, many stories generated. At Beale Air Force Base out in California, Volk Field in Wisconsin, we're going to try to organize something at Shaw Air Force Base in South Carolina, where the list of people to be killed is assembled, and then at Whiteman Air Force Base. And there are other actions that are going on cross-country. There is an effort to challenge the drone warfare, and I think had it not been for that effort, you would see the military bases kind of announcing with fanfare, we've got a drone program going now. But now, if you try to find out the details, you have to look really hard. They're kind of keeping it under wraps at all of these different bases. It's not something that they announce. So I think public opinion, I wouldn't say that it's shifting, and I'm distressed to see that 70% of the public apparently still approves of usage of drones. But I think we've made some progress.
If people want to contact Voices for Creative Nonviolence, they would like to ask questions or support the work that you do, or to find out about some of these upcoming protests, how can they do that?
Well, they can come by and visit if they live in the vicinity. We'd be very happy to welcome anyone. We're just off the Argyle L stop at 1249 West Argyle, and we're always happy to talk with people over the phone, 773-878-3815. Again, I want to encourage this Global Days of Listening phone call on the 21st of every month, and it does mean getting up early. It starts at 7 till 9:30.
Which time zone?
Central Standard Time. Just go to type out Global Days of Listening, and you could send an email if you wanted to talk on the show. Just send an email to info@globaldaysoflistening.org. Otherwise, just go to that website and click on it, or go to our website, and there's a box in the corner on the right-hand side. Scroll down, and you'll see the box. And then people are welcome to email us, either me personally, Kathy@vcnv.org, or our info@vcnv.org.